Case number 13-5279, John Doe, Appellant v. United States Parole Commission, et al. Mr. Henderson for the Appellant, Ms. Roswell for the Appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Sonam Henderson, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Doe. Today, I plan to address two questions arising from the District Court's interpretation of the requirements for imposing special conditions of supervised release that are contained at 18 U.S.C. 3583D. The first question is whether, for purposes of determining if special sex offender conditions meet the reasonably related requirement of 3583D1, sexual misconduct from when a releasee was a child of 11 is essentially equivalent to an adult, a prior adult sex offense.
Counsel, may I ask a question at the outset with respect to your statutory claim, not your constitutional claim?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's the cause of action? You understand? I understand your jurisdictional
yes.
argument, but what about cause of action?
The cause of action is a violation of the sentencing statute under which the parole commission gets its sentencing authority.
That doesn't give you a cause of action. APA, Administrative Procedures Act, gives causes of action, but that doesn't apply here.
I mean, we're seeking an injunction for declaratory judgment.
But counsel, you have to have a cause of action.
Counsel, could this be construed as a habeas because supervised release, like parole, is a form of custody?
I believe so, Your Honor, yes.
But you didn't so state.
We did
you
not.
You never even considered cause of action in the case below. My colleague suggests the possibility of a habeas cause of action, but neither you nor the government made any mention of cause of action. Now, my own view is, since cause of action is not jurisdictional, and you both seem to concede there's a cause of action, we don't really have a problem. And, of course, my colleague points out it could have been phrased as habeas, although that may have some problems. But in any event, nobody focused on the question, which really surprises me about both you and the government.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Just getting back to the questions that I want to deal with today. The first is whether having a sex offense when you're a child of 11 is equivalent to an adult sex offense. The district court said yes. We say that a child of 11 is so different from an adult that the answer has to be no. The second question I plan to address is whether the district court properly held the government to 3583D2's requirement that special conditions involve, quote, no greater deprivation of liberty than is reasonably necessary. Here, where the court itself stated that it might have chosen a less intensive condition than the one imposed, but nonetheless upheld the condition, the answer is again no. Turning first to 3583D1, that provision requires that special conditions of supervised release be reasonably related to either the instant offense or something in the offender's history of characteristics, as well as to the sentencing goals of deterrence, rehabilitation, and protection of the public. The sex offender condition imposed on Mr. Doe fails this reasonably related requirement. On the one hand, it's extremely burdensome. It's going to require Mr. Doe to disclose every aspect of his sexual practice and sexual experience over the course of his entire life, and then be polygraphed on his responses. It's going to force him to attend a group sex offender orientation session where he will be identified to at least the other people in the room as a sex offender or a potential sex offender. And it's also going to require him to go to 16 individual therapy sessions where he will presumably have to, again, further discuss his sexual life and his sexual choices.
Can I ask a question about what the parole commission had before it when it made the decision to first, I guess, impose a treatment, and then they modified it to assessment. There's a three-page, I think, memo to the parole commission that's in the record in the sealed appendix. Is that what the parole commission had before it, or did it have any of the other information before it, like the juvenile records and the psychological evaluation that was done in the course of the juvenile court, et cetera?
Your Honor, it's not entirely clear from the record. We know that they had that memo from CISOSA, and I believe that's all there was. There's no indication that they had additional records when they made this assessment decision. And you see in their own memo describing what they're doing, they're basically just drawing from that CISOSA memo. There's, for instance, that CISOSA memo left out. It discusses that Mr. Doe had a 2003 evaluation from a psychologist, but that memo left out the psychologist's conclusion that Mr. Doe was not a sexual predator, but rather was a naive experimenter. And so the CISOSA memo leaves it out, and then you see no reflection of that conclusion in the parole commission's own memo.
Doesn't it also leave out the fact that there had been weekly therapy sessions for 2 months, and the therapist concluded that there would be no further point to any further therapy?
Exactly, Your Honor. It leaves out that right after he had that evaluation, he went through 2 months of counseling, and the counselor agreed with the initial assessment that he was a naive experimenter and not a sexual predator, and also ended the therapy because it appeared to her that there was no further need for it. So that none of that appears to
have... Do you think it's relevant at all that his latter conviction involved shooting a gun at a woman?
I don't, Your Honor, no. The government made that suggestion in its brief. I would say that half the population is female, men and women.
That's not true. It's more than half.
More than half of the population is female, Your Honor. And men and women interact over 100 things, both positive and negative, every day. And there's just no indication that event had any sexual component to it whatsoever. It just so happened that the person that he had a disagreement with was female. So on the one hand, this is a very intensive condition. On the other hand, it's based on something that occurred when Mr. Doe was 11. And at that age, he weighed 90 pounds. His favorite TV show was SpongeBob SquarePants. He was sexually undeveloped and lacked almost all understanding of sex. And as we've just talked about, there was the evaluation from the Child Guidance and Family Counseling Clinic of the Superior Court that determined that he wasn't a sexual predator, but he was a naive experimenter. And then, perhaps most importantly, in the 11 years since the offense, there's been no hint of any sexual misconduct from Mr. Doe as he's grown into an adult.
Let me turn you to the constitutional questions.
Yes, sir.
Do you think the most serious constitutional argument you have? Are you making a substantive due process argument or only procedural due process?
At this point, we're focusing on the procedural due process argument.
What do you mean at this point? When you go to the Supreme Court, you want to go to substantive due process?
Below, we press both, and in our briefing on appeal, we've pressed the procedural due process.
Yes, you did. All right. What is your strongest argument there?
Your Honor, I believe they're both strong, but I guess I would start with the sexual privacy argument.
You mean that as the liberty interest?
As the liberty interest, yes.
Yes, but then what process are you asking for, or what do you claim was denied? Let's assume, arguendo, there's a liberty interest, but what process was missing?
So are you asking, I'm sorry, the process he got was almost so minimal as to be non-existent, right?
Well, what process would you think would have been appropriate, and what would you have been able to argue for him in what context?
So I think the first and most important thing he should have gotten was meaningful notice. As it was, the notice that he got merely told him that he was going to be subject to a sex offender assessment condition. It didn't tell him what that was. It didn't tell him the evidence that the CISOSA was relying on.
Was he entitled to counsel at that point?
There's nothing entitling him to counsel at that point, no.
Well, wait a minute. There's nothing precluding counsel at that point either.
There's no provision in the parole commission rules that would give him access to counsel. And so at that point, he had no real information about the thing that they were trying to do to him or why they thought what their evidence or reasoning was for trying to do it to him. So I think as an initial step for process, he would need to know what they were doing and why they wanted to do it so that he could contest that. That seems to be a basic thing. We also think that a hearing would be appropriate in which he
appropriate or necessary?
Necessary. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I think that a hearing is necessary. An independent decision maker is necessary. And then I also believe something that he didn't get here that he should have gotten.
Is that true for all conditions, that there must be a hearing?
Sorry?
Is that true for all conditions proposed, that there must be a hearing?
For a condition like this that affects a substantial liberty interest, such as his interest in sexual privacy, then there ought to be a hearing, unless there's already been process that would make the determination. Sorry, I was going to say, Your Honor, the final thing we'd be asking for is a written decision really explaining why the condition's being imposed. Here he got simply a notice from the Parole Commission saying, we're imposing this on you. Again, it didn't say the evidence that it had considered. It didn't say the reasons that it had decided that this was a good idea.
So how do you think that the process that Doe received compares to the process that Mr. Melania received by the very esteemed trial judge who imposed a condition in that case?
Well, I mean, Mr. Melania had a hearing, and he had a written decision. So he had a lawyer, and he had an understanding of why the government was trying to impose the sentence on him. So he received greater process. I think the issue in Melania seems to be a different one, just the decision maker's own internal deliberative process about how the sentence would be imposed or what sentence to impose.
I didn't understand your last point, the issue being a different one.
Oh, so when I'm speaking of due process for, speaking of notice and opportunity to be heard, these sort of standard things that the offender gets to participate in and receive, I had understood the issue in Millennia to be one of the sentencing decision maker's own internal process, that this narrow tailoring, the weighing of the burdens on the offender against the likely effectiveness of the...
In other words, Melania was more of a statutory interpretation.
Yes. That is how I see it.
I assume that what you're focusing on here is the second decision from the commission. In other words, not their initial notice that they were going to treat him as a sexual offender, but their modification of that after his attorney objected.
Just a point of clarification, Your Honor. The Parole Commission didn't make an initial decision. There was an initial request from CISOSA requesting that treatment condition. Mr. Doe opposed that, and then CISOSA changed its request before the Parole Commission
acted. Okay.
And so, yes, when then we're focusing on its action then and imposing the assessment. And I guess I'd like to turn briefly to the 3583D2 issue that we were just speaking about, the statutory issue. This court's recent precedent describes 3583D2 as imposing a narrow tailoring requirement that requires weighing the burdens of the condition on the releasee's liberty against their likely effectiveness and choosing the least restrictive alternative. So this provision seems to entitle Mr. Doe both to have the Parole Commission go through a deliberative process, this narrow tailoring.
All right, what's your view as to what would be narrow tailoring? What would be acceptable narrow tailoring in this context?
Well, Your Honor, we actually think that because of Mr. Doe's age and the time that's elapsed with no further misconduct, there's, focusing on 3583.
Basically, your argument is this condition is inappropriate no matter what.
Right,
but
exactly.
If you go to the narrow tailoring, what is the narrow tailoring? That assumes a condition is appropriate.
If there was a condition that was appropriate, it would I mean, the narrow tailing would require a weighing of burdens that never happened.
Okay, I'm asking you now. You're a lawyer. You've got to tell me what would be acceptable narrow tailoring.
Something much less than this, Your Honor.
Oh, well, Your Honor, I mean, counsel, you can't do that. You can't say something less. How much less? What would it be?
It would be something that didn't go in, didn't require the polygraph, didn't require this intensive investigation of Mr. Doe's sexual history.
So I want to know, you're now given the power to come up with narrow tailoring. What would it be? Don't tell me what it would not be.
If there had to be something, Your Honor, I would imagine something like a short conversation that did not involve any assignment to the sex offender unit or any of this intensive, invasive exploration.
What would the short conversation probe into?
What happened when Mr. Doe was 11, and you know what changes what's happened in his life.
So you could inquire into his sexual behavior for the last 10 years.
Certainly not his perfectly legal sexual behavior with other consenting adults. That without some indication that there's something that you can do with that's going to lead to a meaningful decision, then there's really no reason to go into that.
Was there anything placed in the record by the Parole Commission or CSOSA as to why the assessment had to have all of the components that they have in it?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. There's no... I mean, the Parole Commission in its initial decision made no reference at all to the different components of the condition, which suggests, I think, going back to millennia, that it was, in their mind, just a standardized one-size-fits-all thing that they were just imposing on him without considering what it meant to him as an individual and how it was going to work with him as an individual. And even in the course of the litigation, when CSOSIS had these opportunities to put in affidavits, they've never explained why they need these things or why these things have to be here in order to have the kind of assessment that they feel is necessary. But that just hasn't been part of this. If there are no further questions right now, I'll hope to have some time on rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the Court. The district court correctly concluded in this case that Mr. Doe's...
Isn't the logical thing to start out with is the question I asked in the beginning? After all, if a judge asks a question which goes to a precursor question, which is what's the cause of action, I thought you'd be prepared to say what it is.
Your Honor, I apologize, but that was not litigated by the parties, and therefore the...
What about you? You're supposed to tell the judge, hey, Your Honor, there's no cause of action here.
No, there is a cause of action here. It's because the Parole Commission steps into the shoes of the district court in this situation where the Parole Commission is imposing conditions on supervised release. Because if the district court imposed those conditions, there's review for abuse of discretion.
Of course, but because why is there a review of the Parole Commission?
Because it steps into the shoes of the district court.
And is that the stepped-in provision of the statute? I don't know. I'm not familiar with that.
No, Your Honor, there's not.
In other words, you never addressed it because you didn't think about it, or nobody down below thought about it.
It was not challenged, and...
No, you're the one who would challenge it. You're the one who would
challenge it. I understand that, and there was no basis.
It was not challenged means the government never thought about it.
In the Goings, is it the Goings case before Judge Howell that was recently litigated, didn't CSOSA take the position that this was equivalent to a habeas petition?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. So habeas could be one method, but we can see...
Until Judge Wilkins came up with that suggestion, I was a little wondering. Now, I was prepared to say, okay, we go to the merits anyway, because the parties seem to concede there is a cause of action, and that's not jurisdictional, so we can reach the question. But I'm sort of surprised at the government not raising the issue before the district judge and saying, well, the cause of action is A or B or C, because you have to have a cause of action.
That's correct, Your Honor. That is correct.
I must say I'm a little disappointed in the government.
Well, I apologize that we did not address that very specifically before the district court.
You didn't consider it at all, not specifically. You didn't even alert the district judge.
Your Honor, we didn't address it because, in fact, the government acknowledges that there is a cause of action. And so
acknowledges it, but what's the theory? Is it habeas corpus? Is that what it is? Because that may have major implications. Is that your concession?
In Goines, that was something that was raised as a possibility. But, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I can't give you the specific basis. The government concedes that there is, in fact, a cause of action.
But somewhere in the air.
But isn't this significant? Because one of the arguments that's being made here is that it's a very close question. We're sort of balancing this, you know, the age that he was when all this occurred, the time that has passed when there has been no indication of any kind of aberrant behavior versus the invasiveness of the process that they're trying to impose here. So one thing that it seems to me would be significant is, what is the standard of review? How deferential does this court have to be? And it would make a difference if this were habeas than if we were analogizing it to a district court.
Well, Your Honor, it's well established that the standard of review is abuse of discretion when a court imposes a condition of release.
That's true. But one of the things that the district court says here is, if I were doing this, I might have done this differently. But after all I'm reviewing is what the commission did.
Yeah, the court.
So if that standard were habeas, it seems to me that would be different, wouldn't it?
The district court applied an abuse of discretion standard.
They're both abuse of discretion standards, but they're different. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Now that is correct, isn't it, counsel? But let's raise another issue on the standard of review. Here you have a strange situation where the same condition can be imposed by the parole commission or the district judge. Now, if you analogize that to administrative law, when a case can be brought either before a commission or a district judge, we do not give Chevron deference to an agency, because it's inappropriate to give Chevron deference to an agency, because the matter can come before either the district judge or the agency. Are you familiar with Chevron? Do you understand? All right.
Yes,
so,
Your Honor.
There's sort of an analogy here that this, of course, it's abuse of discretion either way, but Judge Bates seemed to think that he was deferring to the parole commission. It's not clear to me that's appropriate for him to defer, and for us it seems to be the same standard of review whether it comes from the parole commission or the district judge. It has to be the same, doesn't it? The nature of the abuse of discretion.
Yes.
All right. Now, here's another point. Would you not concede that counsel, at minimum, raises serious constitutional questions? I know you argue that there is no violation of due process, but would you concede there are serious issues here?
Not with respect to the facts at issue here. And that's...
Wait a minute, I'm not asking about the facts. I'm asking about the law. Given the basis of the facts, don't you think there are serious constitutional questions?
Well, I don't think you can divorce the law from the facts. I mean, at issue here is an assessment, not treatment. And all of the cases that Mr. Doe relies on, where there is a concern by the court that raises...
There's no cases on your side either.
Well, there's no cases dealing with the juvenile. That's correct.
There's no cases dealing with assessment.
There's district court cases, but not the only court of appeals case is the United States versus Thomas, the unpublished Sixth Circuit case, and even that was not factually similar, although the court said in that case an assessment is like treatment. In fact, there was treatment. There was therapy going on in that case.
So you think the constitutional arguments he makes are minimal or insubstantial?
With respect to the facts at issue here, yes.
Suppose I believe he's made serious constitutional arguments. What scope of review do I have on the legislative question, the reasonableness question?
Well, the reasonable question is a statutory one. The constitutional question.
Listen carefully. If I think the constitutional questions are serious, what impact does that have on the scope of review of the statutory question?
I think the statutory question remains the same. It's an abuse of discretion.
You're not familiar, for instance, with how that is developed under Chevron, again, to look to administrative law. You're not familiar with the Supreme Court case in which Justice O'Connor said if there's a serious constitutional question that, that comes out of an agency determination, the federal court should not give Chevron deference.
But that's within the APA context, and this is not an APA. This is not the APA.
Isn't the logic the same? If I believe there's a serious constitutional question, then my review of the reasonableness is greater than it would otherwise be. In other words, it's an abuse of discretion. But I'm inclined to believe, am I wrong, that my scope of review is greater if I think there's a serious constitutional problem that I don't want to reach.
Your Honor, there may be a more searching inquiry, but that doesn't change the standard of review in terms of being a review for abuse of discretion.
You're not familiar with the administrative law cases that I refer to.
I am familiar with those, Your Honor.
And Justice O'Connor's opinion pointing out that there's Chevron deference is inappropriate if there's a serious constitutional problem.
I am, but I believe that there's a difference between the APA standards and the abuse of discretion standard that applies here. And in this particular case, with the abuse of discretion standard, if the court would find that there is some significant constitutional issues, you would have a more searching inquiry as to the facts at issue here, but you would still apply the abuse of discretion standard. And here there's simply no abuse of discretion in the Parole Commission's decision.
Let me ask you this. Let me ask you this question. The Parole Commission's basically one-page notice said that they were imposing this condition in the interest of public safety. And in the recommendation memo from the case analyst, it says the same thing, that public safety is the reason. How can we say that they properly exercised their discretion when the information that they were given was omitted? The conclusions of the therapist that he was not a predator and a naive experimenter, and the conclusion of the therapist who saw him at 11 for, you know, at least 6 or 8 sessions and said that no further therapy was needed, isn't that inconsistent with the conclusion that more treatment, if no more treatment was needed, then there wasn't a public safety issue at that point? So why 10 years later is there a public safety issue, or why should I have any confidence, I guess is the question, that they really weighed all of this properly when they weren't even given that information about what the two therapists said who evaluated him and then treated him?
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the sealed appendix at 48 through 50, that is another recommendation from CSOSA, because as you know, this started out with a recommendation for assessment and treatment. There was an objection by Mr. Doe, so a new recommendation was made only for assessment.
That's what I'm looking at. And they cherry-picked, the probation officer cherry-picked what she said about the evaluation. It doesn't say, it says, well, he was a compensatory offender, and he needs some sex education therapy, and he never got it, or sex education, but never got it, but leaves out basically the most relevant information from the evaluation.
Well,
tell me where that is in 48 through 50, if I'm missing it.
No, you are absolutely right. He summarizes the information from the evaluation, but it is extremely significant that one of the things that the evaluator, who was a psychiatric intern, recommended was
a master's degree, right?
That's correct. And actually, the therapy, however, was done by a licensed social worker. And it's important to note, with respect to the 2003 evaluation, it was not a sex offender assessment. That's not the purpose. In fact, it's very clear on the first page of that evaluation that the purpose was to determine Mr. Doe's educational and intellectual needs, et cetera. But it was not a sex offender assessment. And CSOSA notes that the recommendation that was made with respect to that evaluation was never followed through by Mr. Doe. That in and of itself would be a basis to allow CSOSA and the Parole Commission to determine that a mere assessment is needed.
Counsel,
they're not recommending.
Well, the mere assessment can be 16 sessions and a polygraph, so it seems to me to be quite intrusive. But what I was sort of astonished about is both in the district judge's opinion and your brief, you refer only to the time between the prior offense and the condition, ignoring the fact that the prior offense, of which he was never adjudged guilty, was an 11-year-old.
Actually, the district court and we both mentioned that it was a juvenile adjudication.
Yes, but your cases that you cite are all based on time difference. You don't have a single case in which you have this kind of time running from an initial event when somebody is as young as 11 years old.
That's correct, because this issue has just not been presented in the courts before. But that doesn't mean that just because there isn't a case that addresses that this then is per se unreasonable.
You're right about that, but it's certainly the cases that rely on time alone are not really relevant, are they?
Well, no, I think that time is still relevant, whether or not you're a juvenile or an adult.
The time runs against you. It's 10 years. But it's you cite cases where if it's an adult who has an offense, 10 years would not be that much of a problem. So suppose he was 7 when this first event took place. Would it still be a reasonable condition?
It would depend very much on the facts. I mean, in this case,
the same facts, but he was 7 rather than 11.
You know, Your Honor, that's hard to speculate because it. One of the things, but I think
you could answer the question. What do you
I think it very likely may.
How about 5?
At some point, I will concede that you're going to get. You may become too young.
Why is not 11 too young? Do you remember what it was like to be 11?
I do, and I think the kind of conduct that occurred here with a forcible sex abuse of a 5-year-old is not experimentation. It's nothing like what the intern said it was. This is not normal behavior. And in fact, Mr. Doe said that he engaged in this behavior because he was bored and his mother was too strict. That's not normal 11-year-old behavior under any circumstances, Your Honor.
He also said that he heard about it from other kids that he talked to, right? Isn't that normal 11-year-old behavior in the sense that you hear about something and you try it because other kids have talked about it?
I think hearing about other behavior is certainly normal, although I don't know about hearing about forcible anal intercourse with a 5-year-old is normal to hear about, and I don't think it's normal to then go ahead and act on it.
Understood, but that is what he said was the motivation, part of the motivation, right?
Actually, he told the police, and his mother told the police, that he said he was bored and his mother was too strict, and that's why he did it.
That didn't come out in the evaluation and the therapist. So am I just inventing that?
No, that was in the police report. Oh, I'm sorry. Are you inventing?
That he also said that he was influenced by what these other kids told him about.
Well, but that's also in connection with other reports, for example, because remember, the mother reported that there was an inappropriate contact with a 2-year-old, so we're not looking at just one incident in isolation. There was also an incident that occurred at the school where apparently he stood around while one young student, one boy, raped another individual.
Well, wait a minute, that's not adjudicated, is it?
No, but the parole commission doesn't have to rely only on adjudicated behavior in order to consider it, Your Honor.
He didn't do anything.
He certainly didn't do anything while it was going on. That's correct. But whether or not to say that that's completely irrelevant, the parole commission is supposed to look at all possible relevant factors. And C. Sosa, in its recommendation, noted that adult sex offenders often start their behavior when they are younger.
That's certainly true, but then you would see some continuation of that behavior through up to adulthood. You don't see that here.
Well, you see that he continues to have impulse control problems and problems dealing
with... Not sexual.
However, the assault incident against was basically against a woman when he shot her house.
No, but that's fortuitous. There could have... That's like saying it's a sex offense if he robbed a pocketbook as opposed to a wallet.
I think it's a little different when you're shooting at somebody's house, and the Sixth Circuit in United States versus Perkins thought that type of information was relevant with respect to the imposition of sex offender treatment, and we're not even talking about treatment here.
But that's an adult.
So,
you keep wanting to say that this is only an assessment, but I didn't see anything in the record that was either put before the parole commission or before the district court that explained why an assessment in this manner, like is the one size fits all, that it has to be this assessment, that this is the least restrictive assessment that can be done, that the only way we can assure public safety is to do all of this with all these bells and whistles and up to 16 individual sessions. There's no evidence of that, isn't it? The parole commission's burden, and that gets transmuted to you to justify that this is least restrictive?
The plaintiffs never challenged any individual part of the assessment, as the district court noted, and indeed even at oral argument they were hard-pressed to try and challenge the specific assessment. And again, you have to remember that the assessment, there's a constant repetition of the 16 sessions, but that's a funding issue. They fund up to 16. They don't know how many they will use.
What about the questions, the list of questions that's in their brief that are a standard part of the assessment, including things like, you know, all of your sexual experiences, basically, that you've had in your life?
But again, we did not address those specifics because they weren't challenged by Mr. Doe before the district court. But how can you possibly try and assess whether or not someone is a potential sex offender without delving into some very personal, very intrusive questions about their sex life? I mean, there's no other way to make an assessment. And Mr. Doe didn't challenge any part of that sexual question. He just took a broad brush approach that all of this was inappropriate because he was a juvenile and too much time had gone by. So it wasn't really the parole commission's burden to go into that kind of detail before the district court when it wasn't challenged by Mr. Doe.
Well, they said that this is in effect treatment. It's just really, you know, treatment by another name. You're calling it an assessment and it's treatment. And you say, well, no, it's not because we do, you know, further follow-up when there's treatment, but you never really explain why this assessment is kind of like the least intrusive manner of proceeding as far as protecting public safety.
Well, we address their argument, which is assessment is treatment, and the supplemental Brennan Declaration that starts at page 100 of the appendix goes into detail as to how assessment is different than treatment. And as the district court noted, an essential part is that there's no behavior modification therapy as a part of assessment. There's also you're not registered as a sex offender. They don't tell collateral contacts like your friends and relatives that you're in sexual offender therapy. You don't have to acknowledge your need for treatment. There's a lot of differences.
Suppose he applies for a job 5 years from now and there's a questionnaire asking whether he has ever been considered for sexual offense through an assessment. Would he have to answer yes?
If there was such a question, he would have to be truthful.
Right.
But there's no evidence.
Wait a minute. Wouldn't that be an extraordinary burden to put on an individual?
Well, but, Your Honor, then what's the answer? You don't do an assessment because maybe down the road maybe an employee might ask?
It only suggests that an assessment is pretty serious business. You have to have a good reason because the consequences for the individual are going to be very grave.
You do have to have a good reason, and they had a good reason here. They had this sex offense that occurred when he was a juvenile. They had not just that one, but they also had other indications of deviant behavior.
A young juvenile.
Still, again, I have 11-year-old. An 11-year-old is old enough to know that this was inappropriate conduct.
Why shouldn't we put some weight on the fact that it's a juvenile adjudication that under the Sentencing Commission's policy guidance wouldn't even be considered at sentencing, at least towards counting towards the criminal history?
Because the Parole Commission is entitled to consider incidents that don't result in convictions.
But doesn't 3583 say that part of what's supposed to be weighed are pertinent Sentencing Commission policy statements. And here, there's a policy statement that goes against counting it, but yet it's the sole basis for the action, and you don't, there's no explanation as to why, notwithstanding that policy statement, we're going to recommend this anyway.
It goes against counting it for sentencing purposes, but for example, Your Honor, the Tenth Circuit in the Iron Cloud decision looked at a juvenile adjudication when trying to come up with the salient factors to determine the risk of whether or not a parolee would violate his parole. And they considered a juvenile adjudication that could not have been considered in sentencing.
But so the salient factor scoring system that's used by the U.S. Parole Commission wouldn't even consider this one, right? Because it has to be a juvenile adjudication that resulted in a commitment over 30 days, right?
For sentencing purposes, that's correct.
So even not for sentencing purposes, but for the Parole Commission's salient factor scoring system, they wouldn't even use it.
But the fact that they wouldn't use it for that particular purpose does not mean they can't consider it for a condition of supervised release. I mean, in the final analysis...
Then why shouldn't we require the Parole Commission to explain all of that, since there's a whole lot of exceptions being made here, and we have no indication as to why they're making these exceptions, what their reasoning is, why this is the least restrictive alternative, et cetera.
Because when you look at the entire record, you can see that there was a balancing done by the government in looking at this because of his objections. They reduced the request from assessment and treatment to simply assessment. Because the case analyst's report talks about these juvenile convictions, because you've got an entity, CSOSA, that deals with sex offenders, that says this kind of conduct often starts during the formative years. So when you look at this record as a whole, you can tell that there was consideration given to the factors. There's no dispute that this juvenile adjudication was part of his history and characteristics. He doesn't even dispute that the other two incidents occurred as well.
He doesn't concede it.
But he doesn't dispute it. And he put in a declaration in district court. One would think that if, in fact, he thought the other two incidents should not have been considered and didn't occur, he would have actually said
they
didn't occur.
Well, the other incident, his mother said, oh, I'm reporting this, but I don't even know what happened. She doesn't even say that it happened. She reported it.
Yes, but there's another document, the objection to reducing his conditions, where the corporation counsel specifically talks about this incident, says it was reported to MPD Youth and Services Division, and describes exactly what the incident occurred with the two-year-old, which was not just some sort of touching. I'm not sure what it was. It was very specific.
So we're to rely on the double hearsay, at least, of the corporation counsel over the mother who was there?
Well, they're not contradictory. The mother just says, you know, I'm not sure what happened.
Nobody knows what happened.
It's not contradictory. Well, they know what the report was. That certainly corporation counsel reported that. And again, there's nothing there. Mr. Doe has pointed to nothing that says that the parole commission cannot consider that kind of information in trying to reach this assessment. And in the final analysis, I know I'm way over my time, but I'm happy to keep answering questions as we go. In the final analysis, even if this court thinks this is a close tie, then it goes to the public. It goes to public safety. I mean, that's the parole commission.
Not if there's a serious constitutional problem.
But there is no serious constitutional problem here.
Well, that's your argument. I must confess, I'm not totally persuaded by it.
There's no serious constitutional problem. There's no constitutional prohibition to looking at a juvenile adjudication and simply doing an assessment.
No, the question is due process.
Here, the process he was given for the assessment, he was given an opportunity to object to the assessment and treatment. It made a difference. The government changed its position to be an assessment. He was given an opportunity to object to that, and he objected and gave no reasons why he was objecting to the assessment. So he's been, and the Parole Commission has now adopted the regulation that is in the proposed regulation that's in the joint appendix has now been adopted on August 28th by the Parole Commission. If, in fact, there was a determination that he was in need of treatment, he would get a hearing. So he would get more process as it becomes more intrusive, as it becomes more serious, if in fact he had to have treatment. But at the assessment stage, he got the process that he was entitled to. And again, in the final analysis, the government has an obligation to try and protect the public safety, and doing this kind of assessment does not raise the kind of serious constitutional due process issues that treatment does. And the courts uniformly have looked at treatment and found
nobody's looked at an assessment, this kind of assessment, and thought about it in constitutional terms. No case.
That's correct. I mean, this is to our knowledge the only case to come before a court to consider it. So, unless there are further questions, we urge the court to affirm the district court here in its finding that there was no abuse of discretion and that Mr. Doe received all the due process that he was due. Thank you.
I know counsel doesn't have any time left, so we'll give you 2 minutes of rebuttal time.
I'd like to make a couple quick points. First, on the issue of assessment versus treatment, there is a little more authority than what they've said. It's not just the Thomas case. I point to United States v. Scott, United States v. TM. Both of those cases involve the imposition of both treatment and assessment conditions. And the court, in deciding that those were not valid given the passage of time, invalidated both the treatment condition and the assessment condition. They didn't say, treatment, no good, assessment, go ahead. They wiped it all out. The second thing I'd say, the government talks about the incident, the childhood incident, as forcible anal rape. There's no indication, first of all, that there was any force. And then in terms of the incident, they're relying on the police report. Mr. Doe didn't plead to those facts. Mr. Doe pled to second-degree sex abuse, which is contact. First degree is penetration. So, and there's no, there is nothing in the record indicating what facts he pled to at that time. So I think we'd really have to just go with the elements of the statute, which are limited to touching and not penetration. And then the third thing that I'd point out, both with regard to the nature of the incident and to the other two unadjudicated incidents that the government keeps bringing up. Those predated the sentencing in the juvenile case, and the district court gave Mr. Doe 9 months of probation, which is, you know, it's a serious sentence, but it's far short of what he could have done. So the Superior Court, with all of this in front of him, made the considered decision that this added up to probation. If there are no further questions, we ask that, because of the district court's errors, both constitutional and statutory, the court reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, counsel. The case will be submitted.